Yeah. You were wondering.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Recorded live.
So I would like, this is Peter Block with John McKnight. I'd like to welcome everybody to the call. Our guest today is Karen, who's going to be talking to us about food, and she's a friend of John's, and John will introduce her for a second. Let me just say that I think Andrew will mute everybody but the three of us. And then if you have a question or comments, there's two ways to participate in this conversation. If you're calling in, you can press *8 on your phone and get into a queue. And then Andrew, who's moderating this for us, will keep track of that. And then after we talk for a while, we'll take your question. And then if you're following along on the web, you can simply post your comments on a chat window, which is on the TalkShoe website that hopefully you can get into. So let me begin, John, maybe a couple comments from you, and then we can get going with Karen.
You know, I think that all over North America, there's just been this rather rapid appearance of a local food movement, a slow food movement. It's coming on so fast, and it isn't managed or concocted by big systems. In fact, I don't think it's sort of eroding the power of big systems. So just like the civil rights movement or the women's movement, it seems to me that they're just growing up out of the experience and the desires of people everywhere, this interest in and focus on food. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was to bring our good friend Karen Lehman into the discussion. I've known Karen, I don't know, 25, maybe 30 years.
Yeah, I think that's it.
All of that time, long before anybody else, was focused on food and its role in community and economy. Karen was there working with farmers in Minnesota and farmers in Mexico and villages in San Salvador. And she has been my guide in understanding the kinds of things that are happening and how they're happening and what they mean. So, Karen, I wonder if you could give people a little bit of a history of your activity in terms of food, and then we can think about some specific questions.
Well, thanks, John and Peter. It's funny because I'm going to start way back because I think a lot of us have a relationship with food, obviously, that starts very early in our lives, and whether we are aware of it at the time or not, we do think about it. So I grew up in the 50s, which is when canned asparagus came out. And if anybody has eaten canned asparagus, you know that that is about the nadir, the low point of the food system. There's nothing worse. And it's not because my mom thought that canned asparagus was good. It's that she was a teacher, and she was coming home, and she was getting food on the table. And actually, there weren't a lot of fresh vegetables like that in the store at that time. And then my grandparents retired to a little farm in the Ozarks, and they subscribed to Organic Gardening magazine in the 60s. And they bought ladybugs, and they grew this organic garden, and I had a tomato that I had never tasted the like of up to that point. And I became really interested in the difference, and I guess it's kind of stuck with me. But the other thing I saw was that little farm in the context of a subsistence farming community where people had maybe one cow, a few chickens, and they also hunted deer on each other's land. You could cross anybody's property line to hunt deer because that was a part of the food, and you would not deny that to somebody. Now, anybody coming in from outside couldn't hunt there. But it was, I began to see how community life can be organized around food in a way that my upbringing in a suburban community in St. Louis hadn't really taught me. because I, you know, going to the grocery store. So what I experienced, I think, in my lifetime was the convergence of a number of movements. You know, John referenced the civil rights movement. Well, we started to see, if you think about the source of the environmental movement, it started in agriculture with Rachel Carson's concern about pesticides and what it was doing to birds, you know, the whole publishing of Silent Spring. So the environmental movement, the modern environmental movement, really had a relationship with agriculture at the beginning. So that started. Then in the late 70s, farmers, I made a little documentary in early 80s of three women who were leaders of farm protest movements, and one of them had been involved in the tractorcade to Washington. Now, I just did a program in Vermont last week, and I think a few people are on the phone today from that, where I asked the question, do people know about the tractorcade? There wasn't a single person in the room who knew that that had taken place, and that's when 40,000 farmers drove their tractors across the country and put them on the mall in Washington, D.C., to talk about fair price for agricultural products. So you had this environmental movement kind of having some connection with agriculture. You had these farmers talking about fair pricing for agricultural products. And over time, then a few years during around that time, we had the Back to the Land movement of people saying there has to be a better way to do this, going back, starting to do organic farming, going off-grid. You know, some of those very farmers were the pioneering farmers of Organic Valley. And you can get Organic Valley, which is a, you know, Organic Valley milk or produce or meat all over the country now. And that's a co-op of co-ops. But it came out of that kind of Back to the Land movement. So what I've seen happen is somewhere around in the 90s, the agricultural price people and the environmental people came together in the National Campaign for Sustainable Agriculture to work on a farm bill that would stop being just about agriculture and start being about food. And at that point, you began to see that something was beginning to tip here. But it wasn't until, I would say, 2000, when the early, maybe 2005, when it all of a sudden it became clear that it really had completely tipped, that more people wanted local, sustainable, organic food than we could possibly supply. So up to that point, people have been trying to promote this better kind of food and were organized in movements to change pieces of the policy, but then, boom, the public was there. And I think that that's what's so exciting now is I see so many young people saying that this is what they want to do with their lives. They want to produce food. They want to cook food. They want to teach people about food. And at the community level, it goes so incredibly deep where you have a huge outpouring of community gardens. I hope you get to see the little link I sent about the veg water and the Peterson Garden Project, where pop-up victory gardens. And I think that people are rediscovering or reclaiming their food cultures. One of the things I did earlier in the 90s was co-found a youth farming program, and we worked with kids from all over, and we taught about food based on their culinary traditions. And in a way, that was our way to strike a blow against McDonald's, because if they could value what their family tradition was, whether they came from Africa or Latin America, then maybe they wouldn't embrace the American bad diet so quickly, and they wouldn't make their parents feel ashamed of what they had brought with them from the countries they left.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
This is Peter. What's your understanding of why there is this interest in it? You know, sometimes it's called food security, you know, and you're right. What do you think is behind it? Is it a health question? Is it a community question? Is it a safety? Is it a political? What's your understanding of what it means to have this interest in food and where it comes from.
In terms of the term food security specifically?
Any of it. Just I'm struck by, well, you're right, that somehow you said after 2000 the public woke up.
What happened in that era that seemed to all of a sudden bring this into the popular domain?
Well, my perspective on that is the evolution and the coming together of these movements. That's, you may not have been in the farm movement, but you were in the environmental movement. You may not have been in the back-to-the-land movement yourself, but maybe you were a co-op shopper in the 70s, and you watched these co-ops, these retail food co-ops grow. And in communities, there was started of lower-income communities, communities of color, the conversation about environmental justice, which then also began to focus on food. So what I see it as is not a thing that happened, but as the convergence of different facets of the public, where the connection started to be made between these. And so all of a sudden food was the linking factor. It has implications for everything, and people could see how what they cared about where it's also reflected in food. And so
also such an everyday and has such a so many different meanings to people. You know,
they do it all the time.
Bread together, yeah. We do it every day. You have to eat.
Right. And I think that people started to get excited. That's the other thing. They began to see that the alternatives were possible.
Now, what you're creating is present. It's today. You know, sometimes these things get, have an element of nostalgia to it. Can't we go back to a time when? I know John and I, in talking about community and neighborhoods that have a function, the response sometimes is, well, that time has passed. But this is happening in urban centers. I know you've got a food shed. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that is that you're putting together around Chicago.
Well, if we think about a city like Chicago, or it could be any place, you could draw a circle around that city and you could say, how much food could we produce ourselves within this circle that to feed this region? And what do we want that to look like? So in Chicago right now, we're looking out, and it's funny how many people use this definition, about 200 miles, which is about what you can drive out to and back in a day.
Wow.
So a lot of farmers do that when they come into farmers markets. They may come from 4 hours or so away then turn around and go back. And if you draw that kind of circle and you say, what do we want this to look like? What we're saying is we want this region to look like a place that has a lot of local businesses building community wealth, whether they're co-ops or they're businesses that are place-based. But we want them to be connected to each other. We want a horizontally integrated network of smaller businesses rather than a few single large vertically integrated enterprises. So that's the kind of vision we have that we're trying to develop by convening different entities, whether they are for-profit or non-profit food system businesses or food businesses that are trying to build that kind of alternative.
Aaron, if we wanted to think about that 200-mile space, we all live in a 200-mile space somewhere, who are the actors? You're very much about creating contexts for connecting the elements that allow us to have a local system and not depend on the big systems. And so who are the key actors? Who are you connecting?
So they are, I can give you some specific examples. We have, it could be a business like Gourmet Gorilla, which was a couple who were sending their child to preschool, and they saw what their child was being offered for lunch, and they said, we can do better than this. And so they started a company to serve local, organic, sustainably produced food to preschool and charter schools kids. They are looking for sources of produce, so they are connected with farmers in the region. They want to connect with farmers. We are connecting them with a processor in Mineral Point, Wisconsin, that built essentially a food processor out of a nonprofit organization that has a clientele that are developmentally disabled, as they describe them, who 32 of whom now work in a food processing business that has served as an incubator for entrepreneurs. So what you're seeing is you start to develop a value network of farmers, of entrepreneurs, of processing, of distribution businesses. Irvin Shelley's Fresh Picks is an online ordering program where you go up there and you can order food, and they 95% of the food that they get is locally produced, and they have long-standing relationships with farmers. But then you also have to think about USDA Rural Development, which is an agency that funds a lot of this kind of work, building relationships then with townships and with counties where they might develop a food policy council. And what you're ending up doing is connecting a web of individuals, informal organizations, associations, institutions into a community that starts to learn from all of the diversity that you bring together.
You know, I noticed on the freshtaste.org site that you sent information about that's purpose to provide leadership that brings interested stakeholders into deeper conversations. And I thought that was an interesting way of stating the purpose. The purpose wasn't so much just about a certain kind of food outcomes, but also create a leadership function and a place for people to come together. Is that part of why you got interested in John's work, you know, for some time?
Well, you know, it's more like I met John early enough in life that I said, this is the stuff. asset-based approach to life is the right way to go for me. And my sense of leadership is really about mobilization, mobilizing people to address the issues that matter to them. And I think when you add an asset-based approach to that, it's not just the issues that are important to them, but what they bring with them to be able to work on those issues. And so a lot of the work that I'm trying to do right now is to think about the incredible diversity of experience that we have right around us. And when we pull those folks together, you can't out of one, I can't out of my head come up with the solutions they come up with. I mean, the opportunity for everything from a neighborhood, you know, at the block level up to this regional network that we're trying to develop of people who are processing food. The kind of...
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, the kind of ideas and then initiatives that come out of that are all because they have been in the same room together.
So this connecting process at this point is really a crucial part of the growth of this particular movement, and you actually were initially commissioned to explore and promote these kinds of connections by a group of foundations, right, in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But we got a lot of people who don't live in the Chicago area, and where might they work look if they were going to see the connective tissue developing where they are? Or if do you know, are there other people and groups like you who see the connecting role and are at work in other parts of the country? Or how could our listeners initiate such an activity?
Well, one of the reasons I put the link up to the Peterson Garden Project is that just about any place, you know, there are people who are thinking about how to pull people together around food. It can be an individual in a neighborhood who thinks that their community should have a food policy council. So a lot of smaller communities, counties, states are developing food policy councils to talk about the issues and think about the larger framework. I say community gardens, I say co-ops, if you're lucky enough to have food co-ops, there are places to go. Farmers markets are one of the most important places that everybody pretty much has in some community nearby, to start to find out how to connect with the local food community. Churches, religious institutions are really interested in a lot of this work, some of them dedicating some of their grounds to gardening. And the thing about food is, I think you practically have to avoid finding people who are connecting around food at this stage of the game.
And if how would I find out whether there's a food policy council in my town or county or in the area?
Now with the internet, I would probably Google it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm just sitting in my house and I'm wondering. But I think you can talk to the city government. They may know. You could talk to a hunger organization. They might know. So an organization that works on food in some way might have some sense of whether there is a food policy council.
Let's imagine a town or city or a county had a food policy council. What are the kinds of things that they address?
So they take a look at the overall policy framework. So, for example, in Illinois, there was a very important, very strong grassroots movement to create a statewide food policy council. And they went around the state and they did listening sessions in different parts of the state to ask people what they cared about. And they actually got a bill passed by the legislature to create a food policy council at the state level. And they wrote a report where they basically set a target for 15% that the state agencies should make a good faith effort to procure 15% of their food from local sources. That they develop a labeling program for Illinois-based products. And that they try to make progress on a variety of issues and support the development of local food infrastructure in the state. Actually, I think it's more like 20%, not 15%. But so they might take on a target like that. They might look at access issues. They might say, do people in our community have access to fresh food? And produce, what would it take to get there? And they might say, we actually need to have more retail outlets for local food, and what kind of policy might we need in order to promote that? So I think it really depends on the local context.
What's been the food chains and the large agricultural, what's their response to this movement, and what's their way of relating to this?
They are trying to move into it as fast as they possibly can. And they're doing it for two reasons. They're doing it because consumers want it. Those of us who eat are sending the message that we want more local, we want more organic, we want more sustainably produced food. The other reason is that it's efficient for them. So, for example, Walmart is trying to localize its supply chains in the Midwest to go north to south and get as much local product in season as they can and transport it regionally. So instead of relying on California, they would go from Minnesota to Texas.
Do you worry about that at all, since Walmart has such a reputation for, finding suppliers, and then their volume is so great than squeezing suppliers, so it's hard to make money?
Yeah, I think that is that is a problem. But, you know, it's interesting because a lot right now in this particular system, there's a lot of relationship-based, we call them value chains instead of supply chains, where farmers have strong relationships with some vendors that they've been working with over time. They've built their businesses together. There's actually a great new book out called Turn Here, Sweet Corn, which is the story of Gardens of Egan, which is a farm in Minnesota. And she basically says, you know, the food co-op movement and the farmers grew up together, and we couldn't have done it without each other. And so the Wedge Co-op, which I have been a member of for many years in Minneapolis, doesn't have written contracts with growers. They make verbal agreements and commitments.
They're probably committed to the success of the grower.
Completely. And the grower
most
knows that.
Processing companies are not committed to the success of the grower. They're committed to low-cost suppliers.
That's correct. So we have a lot of, you know, I would say right now many of us really characterize this whole movement and this system as relationship-based.
And it really, then food becomes a reason for neighbors and local people to get to know each other, get connected to each other.
Yeah.
Like you said, the farmer's market is probably the best community center going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of value chains, right, rather than food change. That recognizes the human possibilities in our being in control of and connected through food. It's a great vision that you've got there. Another thing I wanted to ask a bit about, because I know you've done a lot of international work, and one of the things that I remember you're being involved with was linking farmers in the Midwest with farmers in Mexico, which led you into coming to grips with the international treaty system. Tell me the name of it.
NAFTA, North American Free Trade
NAFTA,
Agreement.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of people thought that sounded pretty good, right? A mm-hmm. free trade agreement between Mexico, Canada, and the United States. But you had another thought on that, and I thought it might be worthwhile for you to just reflect a bit on what was the consequence of that idea.
Well,
it's a wonderful free market idea.
I actually gave testimony to Colin Peterson's committee in Congress, and I wish I had been wrong, because, in fact, most of our predictions were actually rosier than what happened, but we were predicting that millions of people would be driven out of especially corn production in Mexico as a result of NAFTA. And that is precisely what happened. The way we organized to address that challenge was we took farmers from the U.S. to Mexico and farmers from Mexico to the United States, and what they discovered is that each of their countries was telling them that they would benefit from the agreement. And when they got to know each other, I can remember one moment we had taken some farmers from Kansas and Texas to a community in state of Guanajuato in Mexico, and we're sitting around in this village, and the Mexican farmer says, the problems we have are the same. The scale is different. Because we were there with a guy, Harold Bob Bennett from Texas, who had, you know, over a 3,000-acre farm. And when he described what was happening on his farm, that's when this guy said, when this campesino said that from Mexico. He understood, he recognized the system that they were part of. And we worked actually quite hard to say, you know, these crops like corn that are produced by peasant farmers for their own use and for their country's use should be treated differently in international trade than commodities. They should not be viewed as commodities. So what most people don't know is Mexico was self-sufficient in white corn production in 1993, the year before NAFTA was signed. They could produce their own food. And just a few years later, they were importing huge amounts from the United States because we destroyed the price system in Mexico that allowed those peasant farmers to raise that food. But what we did, I think there was, by bringing people together and connecting them, nobody could have told them from outside, no, what your government is telling you is wrong. They had to learn it from each other.
What impact did that have on the farmers from Kansas and the U.S.?
Well, one of them said, you know, I have migrant farmers. I mean, I have migrant workers on my farm. He said, I never thought about the fact that they're actually farmers. He said, you know, and there's not a farmer in the United States practically doesn't have to have an off-farm job, and these folks just have a longer commute. So it was a huge opportunity for people to see their commonalities when they're working in similar kinds of production and how the impact of international policy was going to affect them. And we had American farmers say, we don't want to make money by just selling more volume into Mexico if we're going to break other farmers. We'd rather have a higher price and be able to make a living in the United States with it.
Let me pause. We've been talking for about half an hour. If you're on the call, if you would have a question or comment you'd like to make, if you'll press star 8 on your phone, we'll get into a queue and an answer. Andrew can kind of put you on, so I encourage you to do that. And then if you're online, we've had very few comments, but if you'd like to chat a question or type in a question, that would be great also. So, Andrew, is anybody lined up? Anybody have a question that we could?
So far, we don't have anyone.
Okay. It would be great.
Also, experiences that people have.
Yeah, or just
that they can share about food and its community building capacity.
So we encourage you to hit star 8, and that way we kind of gives us some sense of what kind of listening is out there, so Karen and us can kind of focus in that direction. So you'll interrupt us and let us know, Andrew, if somebody wants to comment or share.
Yeah, I'll interrupt.
Thanks. So tell me about the urban work you're doing, Karen. I know there's a huge community garden movement. Cincinnati has about 35 of them. I also read about where local stores, I know you used the term food desert. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit and help us understand that.
The idea of food desert is a controversial one because, you know, now people are talking about food oases because, you know, when you think about a food desert, that's actually kind of a deficit-focused definition. But it's really a place where people don't have access to food because the grocery stores are too distant from, and it's difficult to get there on the bus. What's happened, I think, in urban communities, and in Chicago recently, and I think this is happening all over the country, we got an urban agriculture ordinance passed, which makes urban agriculture an approved use in commercially zoned land in Chicago. Prior to that point, people who were growing food for sale were actually doing it illegally. There wasn't an approved use for it. And so the recognition by many cities that this is going to be something that people are going to continue to want to do, and that it's actually creating a working landscape in cities where there's been a lot of disinvestment, a lot of open land created as a result, is creating an opportunity for food as there's actually a food as an economic development approach, as well as just a nutritional opportunity for people in lower income communities in urban areas.
Hey, Karen. We actually have a question from Southwest Ohio.
Okay.
Why don't we hold the second? Finish the thought, Karen, then we'll take the question.
Okay.
Thank you.
What we're seeing is communities that are planning around food, you know, creating an urban agriculture district and then seeing that there's a community college there that has a culinary training program.
Yeah.
And how they could connect people and food that's produced in the neighborhood with the chefs who are being trained in that culinary program, and then how people in the community who may be coming out of prison and learning how to farm as part of their transition out of prison take what they learn and either turn it into a next part-time job or just start becoming interested in growing food for themselves and their families.
Really kind of a low cost of entry business, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially with the like you say, the land that exists in these urban centers. Why not, you know, return them to the
It unfortunately is still pretty expensive because there generally has to be some environmental remediation done, but people are working on ways to bring that cost down.
Gotcha.
And is there any city in particular, one or two that you could name, that you think have good supportive food policies for people who would want to follow up and find out about that?
Well, I think that I am not an expert on the food policies in different cities because I've been focusing more here, but I will say that people should look at what's going on in Detroit and how people are reclaiming land. I met a woman who has a tractor, and she says when they take a house down in her neighborhood, she starts farming there.
And they've got 50% of the people have moved out of Detroit.
Yeah.
Which is looked at as a deficit, but here you have an incredible urban acreage.
Yes, and they're doing some incredible things there.
But
let me interrupt for a second, Andrew. Can we take the call?
I'll unmute him now. So we had a question from Southwest Ohio, and they're on now.
Hi, this is Nash in Cincinnati, and. I guess our question is, our farmers market in our community is a community center, but the lower socioeconomic population really isn't a part of that. And I was wondering your thoughts on how to bring them into, educate and bring them into what the farmers market movement is.
So there's a really exciting initiative that the Wholesome Ways pioneered and the Fair Food Network has picked up in Michigan. And it's a double value program for recipients, SNAP benefit recipients who shop at farmers markets. And basically what they do is they offer an incentive to people who use SNAP by saying, all right, if you're going to the farmers market and you buy $6 worth of produce, we'll give you another $6 to spend on produce. So they actually double the value. And what they've learned is even after that incentive goes away, people continue to come back to the farmers markets because they figured out a strategy. They know that at the end of the market, things are liable to be cheaper because the farmers don't want to take them back with them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did some research on why people come back and why people want to go to the farmers markets, one of the things they say is we actually want to support local farmers.
Yeah.
That was a surprising outcome for them because they thought people would be saying, well, because the food's fresh, because I can get it cheap at the end of the day, whatever, whatever. But they actually wanted to have that connection with the farmer.
Hmm.
So if you don't have a double value program, it's one of the things that foundations will support. And
okay.
Wholesome Wave is a resource for that.
Wholesome Ways is?
Wholesome Wave, WAVE.
And you'd find it on the Internet?
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
You know, Matt raised an interesting question. Is there another call, Andrew?
No, we don't have any more questions at the moment.
About, you know, the food and the African-American community and the food crisis and all that. It just seems like having them engaged in this conversation would be so useful. Because I know some areas have even put limits on the number of fast food restaurants in certain neighborhoods, trying to do something about it. Bloomberg in New York, you know, has limited, outlawed 1-liter soda pop bottles. And so any thoughts, Karen, about how to move even more and engage more African-American community or people like that in this conversation?
Well, I think it's all about finding the leadership and supporting leadership in those communities that are working on this. I mean, I've had people come to my office. I had a woman come in. She had an entity called Five Black Women, and she said, I want to do a mobile kitchen. where I can teach people to cook out of a trailer, you know, or out of a food truck, you know, and I've worked with another couple who started an organization called Black Oak Center, you know, where she's a doctor, but she started prescribing vegetables for her patients, and then she started bringing those vegetables to her office, and then they started something called the Healthy Food Hub, which is a buying club of 400 people who go to the Betty Shabazz International Charter School every other Saturday to pick up and their produce. And when you look around at what people are starting, if you just find them and figure out how to get some support to what they're trying to do. I don't know if people saw this big thing where Michelle Obama came to Walgreens in Chicago because Walgreens was going to start sourcing, you know, selling produce as a way to address this issue. What nobody knows is that the reason that Walgreens started selling produce is that there was an African man who had a little produce cart that he set up in front of Walgreens. He was selling produce in front of Walgreens. And then he asked if he could be right in front of Walgreens, you know, close to the store. And they learned enough from him to say that they could sell produce in their store. But that piece of the story got lost, that it was his initiative to start with.
Wow. You know, we have a hardware store here in Cincinnati that sells produce. And
also, one of the things from my days in neighborhood organizing I learned is that so many people who are immigrants, especially from the South and from Latin America who come here, come from an agricultural background. And, of course, then they become so-called urbanized and join the industrial world. But I don't think there's a lack of knowledge about how to grow food in either the African-American community or in the Hispanic communities because of the historic nature of this migration. And I think especially in people who are a little older, it provides a great opportunity for them to recover skills and capacities that they know from their early days.
Great point. You know, somebody's written on the chat that Erica Allen is Chicago's growing power. But I don't know, Karen, if you're familiar. She says her dad is Will Allen, who started
yes.
Growing Power in Milwaukee. So
mm-hmm.
Just maybe you might want to reflect on that a little bit.
So Growing Power has in Milwaukee is the one of the best known and pioneering organizations in creating a real urban food system, in that it's a closed loop. You know, they grow tilapia, they make compost, they have greenhouses, you know, they have all kinds of distribution programs, and they train new people in urban agriculture. And Will Allen was recognized by the MacArthur Foundation and got one of their fellowships for his contribution to the field. And then they have, you know, Erica is the director of their program in Chicago, which also has a real focus on greenhouse or hoop house production, which are low-cost greenhouse structures where you can grow almost year-round, even in a climate like Chicago's.
Great. You know, I know, you know, with the gift-based approach, a lot of people run food kitchens for homeless and other people. And when they start asking them, what do you know how to do or love to do, the number one thing is cooking. And so there is, like you said, John, there is an already existing relationship with food, and that's the wonderful way of thinking about that. Now, Andrew said there's another person who's got a question or a comment. Maybe we could take that now, Andrew.
Yeah, guest 38, you are ready to ask.
Oh, hello, hi. I'm very happy to hear this conversation going on. I'm calling from St. Petersburg, Florida, and I'm actually a member of our Sustainable Urban Agriculture Coalition.
What's your name?
My name is Chelsea.
Hi, Chelsea. Thanks for calling. Keep going.
And I'm familiar with Growing Power, and I've been doing research on policy and zoning, and I've become familiar with some of these other urban ag community groups and whatnot. And I was wondering if you all have any knowledge of how some of these more successful programs have been able to fund themselves, and how they got it done personnel-wise. I don't know if that's specific enough to cover right here. I know we're working off of a grant right now, so I was just wondering if you had insight on, you know, how I've heard some information on, you know, community investment and whatnot, and we are trying to get the local municipalities involved and invested with us. But we're also trying to make sure that we're using our energies as, you know, in a conservative way.
So it's a really interesting question, and it's a difficult one. But I think that there is one place to look is at your community bank for Community Reinvestment Act money. For example, there was I mentioned before the double value program for farmers markets. One community here in Illinois went to the bank and asked for money to support a double value program for SNAP recipients at the market, and they got money to do that.
Wow.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Community Reinvestment Act, it's a requirement for banks that was won by a large social movement in the United States, requirement that they invest in their communities. It grew out of practices by banks where they called redlining, where they actually drew a red line around neighborhoods and said they weren't going to lend money in those neighborhoods. And that policy was challenged and fought, and the community grassroots-driven support for a Community Reinvestment Act resulted in that legislation. So now any bank, before it branches, has to show that it's going to invest in its local community. So that's one place. Foundations are another place, if you have any local foundations. And another is there's a very good program at USDA called the Community Food Projects Grant Program. And it is a community-based, food system-based program. When we started the youth farm, we got our first year was $10,000 from a neighborhood organization. Then we got $15,000 from an anonymous donor. We wrote a Community Food Projects grant, and we got $170,000 for 3 years from USDA. And it was what launched us and got us going. So looking at those kind of private sources, foundation sources, federal and state sources, there may be opportunities.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, thanks so much for that input.
Sure thing.
Anybody else?
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? We'd love to hear.
No, we don't have any at the moment.
Karen, one other thing that I wanted to learn more about from you. It seems to me that one thing that promotes the 200 miles becoming much more productive around you in terms of food is that there's a market for the food that that values the fact that it's locally produced. I mean, that's the critical thing. And I remember talking to a young woman who I think works for the county, Dane County,
mm-hmm.
where Madison, Wisconsin is. And it was her job to go to the larger institutions where food was served
mm-hmm.
in Dane County. She might have gone, I know she went to some hospitals, she went to some of the schools, she went to some of the universities, she went to corporations that had significant lunchrooms, and interested them in buying their food within the 200-mile radius of Madison. And I thought what she was doing had a tremendously positive effect in beginning to enhance people who would want to be food producers and having a market, or the people who are already there expanding their activities. So that, I'm just wondering if you comment, the creation of a local market is itself something that leads to a desire for these kind of links then to be made.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're seeing nationally is the national farm-to-school movement has become very powerful. And I think, you know, against all odds, because school food, for example, has they have some of the lowest budgets to work with, but everybody recognizes that some of the primary nutrition that kids get is in school. So that's a problem and an issue that people have to work on. And it's an incredible conversation right now going on among parents with school food service, with farmers, with distributors. Here in Chicago, well, at the Chicago Public Schools, I know that they actually, the contract that was awarded to the company required them to have a local procurement provision, which has meant all kinds of relationships had to be developed. So I think that whether it happens in Dane County, whether it happens in Chicago, whether it happens in a community of 10,000 people, even the conversation about what kind of food do we want in the school, what kind of food do we want in the hospital, can produce a whole set of new relationships that actually can drive business and create jobs for people, as well as providing food.
Yeah, and when you think about scale, my last memory, maybe not quite accurate, is there are like 450,000 students in the Chicago schools.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that as a market, right, that could be directed toward local production from the level of the backyard garden to the level of the small farm, it seems to me that just one of these institutions can be hugely powerful in priming the pump locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And one of the conversations we're in, there's an organization called School Food Focus, which has just started something they call the Upper Midwest Learning Lab, where they are working with large school districts in the Upper Midwest to really work on procurement of better food for their students. And it's a we need to build the smaller processing and distribution and farming networks around smaller school districts that can then grow to sort to supply some of these larger school districts. And that's the evolution that we're in is, you know, John and I both knew Bob Rodale, and he had this idea about pioneer enterprises and a developmental kind of regenerative approach to communities and economies. And the idea that we have some smaller businesses that serve markets that they can then grow with so that they can supply larger markets, we see that happening now with smaller school districts in rural areas with larger that then can potentially evolve so that the processing facility there can send food into something like Chicago. So that's the other kind of dynamic that's at play right now in the food system.
Wouldn't want to leave food as though it's just a thing. It is obviously the way more communities come together than any other around a table, around a meal. Right? And we've done some research in Chicago neighborhoods about what young people want to learn. And believe it or not, in some of the lower income communities, given a whole series of possibilities of what they might want to learn, the top one, and it's clearly the top, is cooking, is learning how to cook. And so it seems to me thinking as well about the level of the meal and its preparation is a whole area for community economic development that is now very powerful. You got a lot of young people who think being able to cook is really important. You see the proliferation, it seems to me, of of local restaurants. You see local restaurants that are also very interested in providing local food. So you've got a nexus there between health and jobs and economy and community. We're around the table. So I think at that level too, not just the systems, but just the preparation end of food, it has a lot of community possibilities.
Yes, and I think one of the untapped, relatively untapped assets are people who know how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And we found this, you know, with the youth farm where we had a mother of one of the participants who was from Mexico who didn't speak English and nonetheless taught the kids how to cook Mexican food. That people know how to do this stuff, and you don't need to get a chef to come in and teach people how to cook. So I think it's really seeing the assets in communities is the fundamental piece of this.
Have you noticed, I mean, there's great parallels around the local questions, you know, that are everyday questions, such as taking caring for our children or being safe. Is there much overlap or interaction? You know, one of the things that so strikes me, Karen, about your thinking is that it's very conversation and relationship-based. You know, a lot of people may think, well, you have to be an expert on food and food processing and production and sourcing, but most of your conversation seems to be who you bring together so they can find each other and realize they have resources, whether it's between countries or between neighbors. Any coming together of movements across the boundary of, say, into safety and children or other kind of things that you notice happening?
Funny that you should mention that. I have a bit, you know, and John also knows, Ken Dunn here in Chicago, who years ago started something he called the Turn a Lot Around program, and they would go and they would find a vacant lot, and they didn't care who they belonged to, and they would put a garden on it. And before long, they were actually contesting turf with the gangs. And it got to the point where they would get there early in the morning to turn the lot around because the gangs would try to beat them to it. But I think I have heard a wonderful story out of Milwaukee, a woman named Venus Williams, who has a garden at a site that was the a site on the Underground Railroad. And she took, you know, she confronted a guy who was selling marijuana, and she said, look, why don't you come over here and grow something? And, you know, he poo-pooed her, but then eventually he actually did. And what has, you know, I think we see these little small stories of individuals who see other opportunities because of interacting people with people in community around food. But we're also seeing that there is a really a lot of focus on people who are coming out of prison doing this work as transitional jobs.
A bridge for people who are somewhat.
A bridge.
Yeah.
And the way they talk about what that experience was for them, not just, you know, that it wasn't a job, just about how healing it was.
Gave them a support group.
And a sense of
membership. Yeah.
Growing something.
Oh, wow. That's
and amazing. Being outside. And working physically. And some, you know, we talk about African-American communities, but I have heard, and I think people, that there's a lot of feeling like that's going back to slavery when you work in the ground. And people want to get away from that. But what I am seeing now with some of the organizations that are working with ex-offenders and the rest is that that's changed. Or that's
wow.
changing, and that this new generation is interested in farming. And in fact, we're working with an organization that's just gotten a grant from USDA to try to train a new generation of African American farmers.
That's amazing. It's like to think that working in the ground is that's almost a colonist notion. So these people are being decolonized. Now we're right about at the 2 o'clock Eastern time. So any final thoughts, Karen, you'd like to share with us? This has been wonderful. We're so grateful to have you on the program.
Well, it's really wonderful. I just wish I could answer. I know some of the questions that may not have been voiced. I do want to say that I thought of an answer to the question about food policy councils and the Community Food Security Coalition, CFSC, if you want to Google that, has a lot of information, especially about food equity and access, food security, and they have been the generators of the food policy council movement in the United States. So that's a good place for more information.
Is there
about
a website
that.
Or a way people can contact you, Karen?
They can contact me at karen@freshtaste.org.
freshtaste.org.
Yep. And I'm just excited actually to be in this moment with everyone on the call, because I think if you look at what's happened in the economy and people have continued to move and make progress in local food businesses, it's an astonishing thing.
Well, you're astonishing in having committed to this for so long in such a wonderful and generous way. So thank you very much. John, any
final
thoughts?
Much, Karen, for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to thank everybody who showed up. We had a great, great response. And thank you all. And this will be the recording will be available on the Abundant Community website probably in a day or so if you'd like to check back in or tell other people about it. And thanks for coming. And, Karen, again, thank you. Just amazing listening to you. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
Bye, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.